Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
It is a little difficult to take groups like this seriously, from commercials featuring half-clad or completely unclad actresses, their campaigns against fur, eating meat, extreme language and ideas, all done with a touch of humor. It's very difficult to take animal rights groups like PETA very seriously. And now a term, speciesism, is part of our vocabulary. What does it mean? I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Colleen Carol Campbell joins us to talk about speciesism. She's a fellow for the Ethics and Public Policy Center, author of the book, The New Faithful, and she writes a weekly column for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Colleen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
It's difficult to take these people seriously, the people who would coin a term like speciesism. I remember when President Barack Obama was caught on camera swatting at a fly. He was actually pretty quick at it, and they said something about it being an execution. Perennial overreactors, PETA. It's
right.
Hard to take them seriously.
It is, but the reason we need to is that PETA is just the tip of the iceberg, and many other animal rights activists and organizations that have a more moderate public face have the same radical agenda as PETA. The Humane Society of the United States is one of them. Don't be confused by that name. That's not necessarily affiliated with your local shelter. In fact, chances are it's not. But because of that Humane Society moniker, they've been able to get away with, again, pretty radical agenda. So the animal rights movement is one that is marked by extremism more than moderation and more than most Americans realize.
What kind of extremism are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the end goals of the animal rights movement. And Wesley Smith is an author who just has a new book out on this. So if any of your listeners are interested, he's a great resource. His book is called A Rat is a Pig is a Dog is a Boy, which you may recognize as a famous quote from Ingrid Newkirk, president of PETA, who basically said all mammals are equal. But the agenda is basically to wipe out any use of animals for human benefit or to alleviate human suffering. So we're not just talking about no more trophy hunting or factory farming. We're talking no more meat eating, no eating sushi, no eating dairy or eggs, actually, for that matter, no more guide dogs for the blind, visits to the zoo, no more household pets, which animal rights activists believe is a form of indentured servitude. So really, our lives would be radically different. We'd have to give up everything from our leather shoes to our wool sweaters and even silk scarves. Because animal rights activists, groups like PETA, have said that silkworms are feeling beings who shouldn't be exploited. Even beekeepers have come under the fire of animal rights activists who say that the hive queens are subjected to rape racks in order to get their honey. I mean, you see where this is going. But at the root of all of this is a radical ideology that holds that humans and animals are equal, and in some cases, frankly, that animals' rights supersede the rights of human beings. And it's a real problem, and it's frightening how quickly this has caught on in America.
Have they been able to convince or at least confuse the American public here?
Yes, absolutely. And confusion is the name of the game here, because it begins with some confusion around the wording itself. Now, I think most Americans would agree that we need to defend animal welfare. The idea of treating animals humanely, not simply because they deserve it, but more importantly because as human beings, we have the responsibility as moral agents to treat animals with respect and humanely. So that's animal welfare, and that's a good and noble cause and a longstanding one, and one that most Americans support. Animal rights, however, is a term that has come to stand in for animal welfare, even though it means something very different. So you'll often talk to people who say, yeah, I believe in animal rights. I don't want to see animals abused. Well, actually, those are two very different statements. Animal rights is the ideology that holds, again, that animals actually possess moral rights, which we know is not possible, mostly because animals also don't have moral responsibilities. Rights always go with responsibilities. Animals are not capable of having moral responsibilities, and neither are they bearers of rights.
Well, we recently interviewed Wesley about his book, and he's a regular guest on the program. And he pointed out that there's really a deep fallacy at work here, stemming from what you just said, that we as human beings are said to have duties toward the animal kingdom precisely because we are moral beings. We have a moral center and can observe moral boundaries. And yet, according to the animal rights activists, animals have no duties to us, although they are supposed to have the same rights that we have.
Exactly. It makes no sense. And, I mean, we can see this in action. Animal rights activists, of course, up in arms, as most Americans were about the dogfighting scandal surrounding Michael Vick. But you'll notice no one was calling for a prosecution of his pit bulls. We wanted to prosecute Michael Vick. Similarly, in the SeaWorld incident last week where a whale trainer was drowned by a killer whale, again, the scrutiny fell upon the executives at SeaWorld, not its orcas. They were not called murderers because we don't believe animals are capable of murder. They're simply animals doing what animals do. When they hunt each other, when they attack each other, when they kill each other, we don't say that they are moral degenerates. We say they're being animals. And so we hold ourselves to a higher standard, and that's because we recognize, and I think even implicitly many animal rights activists subconsciously recognize, that human beings are different, called to higher standards. But what's problematic about this ideology is not simply that it doesn't make sense, but that it actually chips away at the foundation of human rights. And you can see this in radical environmental activists and also animal rights activists who basically are so focused on the rights of animals and to an extent also plants, that they believe many human beings don't have the same right to life and flourishing that some animals do. So you have people like Princeton philosopher Peter Singer, who has argued that chimps and dogs and pigs would have a higher, basically, quality of life and therefore be more entitled to these rights than demented human beings, profoundly disabled infants, that sort of thing. So he's a champion of infanticide in the sense that he has said it can be justified if you are basing human rights on someone's rationality or self-awareness. And so you can see where this is a slippery slope. In some sense, he deserves some credit for at least taking all of this to its logical conclusion. It's a horrifying conclusion, but it is logical. Many animal rights activists haven't quite gotten there yet, but I think they will if they keep following this very misanthropic, muddled thinking about animal rights.
Is there any way to gauge where many animal rights activists may stand on an issue like abortion, where human lives really are at stake every single day?
Well, we've seen by and large that animal rights activists do not seem to share pro-life views. In fact, many of them are quite vocally supportive of abortion because there is, again, this misanthropic view of the world. There's the idea, and we see this among radical environmentalists as well, that human beings are a form of pollution, that our presence is threatening the lives of animals and plants, and therefore we're the ones who should step back, be very concerned about overpopulation, even though, of course, demographers tell us that the graying of our population is a bigger problem than a baby boom. And so we see this sense of almost that human beings have less of a right to be here and to be flourishing and reproducing than the animals. So again, it's sort of a hatred of one's own self and one's own species, all under the guise of not being speciesist. So it's a sad ideology. It's strange, but what's even more sad is the fact that so many Americans pick up that moniker, animal rights, and run with it, and they don't even realize what it is that they're signing on to agree with by saying, yes, I'm for animal rights.
So then with only a minute here, what is the fundamental problem with the worldview behind a term like speciesist?
Well, certainly those who coin that see it as an arbitrary form of discrimination, but actually it is a sense, in a sense, discrimination, but we are exactly right to discriminate between human beings and animals, and that's because human beings alone, in all of creation, are moral agents, and we were given an intrinsic and unique dignity. And part of that is the very reason we have debates like this. You don't see the squirrels sitting around having radio talk shows about human rights violations. They're not too worried about it. Well, that's exactly because because of our own human exceptionalism is a term that's used frequently, and I think it's a good term. We are exceptional within nature. Our human dignity is something that must be defended, and we can't sort of lump everyone else in with human beings and still retain that singular defense of human dignity. It's unique, intrinsic dignity, and we have it simply because we are human, whether or not we possess these various attributes that we may or may not share with some animals. Human beings are unique and need that dignity defended singularly, and that's something all of us need to take on, and that's I think a profound part of the Judeo-Christian worldview, and it's one that we all need to defend, and we need to step back from this animal rights terminology and really reassess our priorities when it comes to defending animals versus human beings.
Real quick, I know the column only ran this morning, but any reaction to it from your readers?
A little bit of reaction, but I have email comments, so I usually don't check those until it's had a little time to be out there. But I will say, when I write about trying to distinguish animal rights from animal welfare, I get some support, but there are a few things that provoke more ire than any attacks on animal rights. People are very passionate about this issue, and unfortunately often fairly uninformed as well. So this is one of those sort of culture wars issues, interestingly enough, and it's one that I think Christians need to be more aware of.
Colleen Carroll Campbell is a fellow for the Ethics and Public Policy Center, author of the book The New Faithful. She writes a weekly column for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and you can read her columns at issuesetc.org. Thanks, Colleen.
You're welcome, Todd.
When we come back from this break, Pastor Todd Peppercorn is going to join us. We've been doing a weekly series with him on the penitential psalms. Today we're up to Psalm 38. We're going to be talking about this kind of wretchedness. If you read what the psalmist says there, it's pitiful. He sounds like he is exposed to the wrath of God. He desires something, anything, to hide him from God's wrath and the forgiveness of his sins. We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. To find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron, check out the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc. and you.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Regulating who is fit to be born in Great Britain.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The agency that regulates fertility clinics in Great Britain recently authorized clinics to destroy embryos carrying certain genetic conditions. The list of more than 100 conditions includes relatively minor disorders. For instance, one that may cause mild anemia is on the list. Pete Sampras, a 7-time winner of Wimbledon, has that condition. Also on the list, Marfan syndrome, which can lead to abnormal growth. It is believed that Abraham Lincoln and French President Charles de Gaulle, among others, had this condition. If being genetically perfect is the requisite for being born, we're all in danger.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.